Woo! Everyone. Democracy needs us right now. They tell me that trying to overwhelm people is part of the administration's political strategy, and maybe you're thinking, well, it certainly feels like it's working. Are you afraid? Tired? Angry? Yeah, me too. But no matter how much fear is in our hearts, there will still be room for love. And I can think of no higher calling right now than to sing democracy's praises. So all this month, that's what we'll be doing. 4 new episodes all about democracy, coming out each Wednesday. It's a new season of I Heart This, everyone. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. I was 11 years old when demonstrators occupied Tiananmen Square. That week, my parents made an exception to the no TV during dinner rule to watch the news, and we huddled around the little screen without even clearing the dishes. More than 30 years later, I vividly remember the image of a man standing alone in the middle of a broad avenue. The street was empty, or it seemed that way until the camera panned out to show a column of tanks rumbling down the asphalt right toward him. The man was turned away from the camera, arms by his sides, with some kind of bag or satchel in his hand. The hairs on the back of my neck prickled as he repositioned himself right under the cannon of the lead tank. And that tank ground to a stop. Having grown up in the United States, freedom had always been something that had happened in the past, when men in powdered wigs and tri-corner hats had played Yankee Doodle and flouted the redcoats. But that evening, the fight for liberty didn't look like an oil painting of Washington crossing the Delaware. It looked grainy and urgent. What if that was my country? What if that was me? Would I have the courage to stand in front of the tank? That moment, watching one man stand in defiance against the enormous machine of the state, is the first time I ever thought about standing up for liberty in the present tense. That was June of 1989. It was an historic year. Even as a kid, I could feel it. The same week that the tank man made the world stand still, communism collapsed in Poland. And then the Iron Curtain came down in Hungary, and by November, only 5 months later, the jubilant people of East Germany took sledgehammers to the Berlin Wall and danced and wept with their reunited families in the rubble. I knew nothing about communist dictators or the East German surveillance state, but I didn't need to understand the joy in those people's faces. Even as an 11-year-old growing up in a tidy Connecticut suburb, I could feel their hope. That year, democracy felt like an unstoppable rising tide. Strongmen and their cronies might keep people down for a while, but it couldn't last. Eventually, people would rise up. Eventually, justice would win. It had to. Democracy was inevitable. Then I grew up. It turned out that democracy was anything but inevitable. It was hard to secure and easy to lose. This became especially clear in the spring of 2010, when another wave of history-making uprising spread across the Arab world. I was an overworked and underslept new teacher with little bandwidth for world events. I got most of my news on my harried commutes to school. On the radio, protesters told reporters how they wanted to go to school and speak their minds and no longer be afraid of the police. Even without images, I could still feel the same thrill of hope that I felt in 1989. Could you imagine what a world it would be if democracies bloomed across the deserts from Gibraltar to Damascus? I mean, could you imagine? But imagination was all it was. As spring turned into summer, hope dried up. The dreams of one country after another were smothered in the crib. Religious extremists grabbed power in Egypt. Bashar al-Assad gassed and starved his own people. Libyan warlords trampled innocent bystanders as they squabbled over the scraps of the Gaddafi regime. On the radio, voices of hope became voices of despair. People pled with the world for help, to give their country a chance to get on its feet before another dictator took the place of the last one. And then pundits would come on to explain how it had all gone so terribly wrong, and I would shout into my empty car that somebody had got to do something. But whatever help came was too little, too late. Of the 17 countries that rose up, only Tunisia escaped from sinking completely back into dictatorship or civil war. In my adult life, anti-democratic regimes have spread like weeds. Putin in Russia, Erdogan in Turkey, Orban in Hungary, Lukashenko in Belarus, Maduro in Venezuela, Kagame in Rwanda. The Chinese Communist Party has tightened its stranglehold on dissent with Orwellian surveillance. Iran's so-called Islamic Republic tortures and disappears women who dare to uncover their heads. Vladimir Putin's misinformation minions scatter the seeds of mistrust throughout the world. In the words of Anne Applebaum, a journalist who has extensively covered the rise of these regimes, they have little in common except a determination to undermine both the language and the reality of liberal democracy. But wait, wait. Undermine the language of liberal democracy? I mean, are the autocrats actually trying to make an argument against democracy? I mean, I always knew that authoritarians existed. They opposed democracy because it stood in their way. But were they really trying to make a reasoned case against it? Did they really think that they could convince people that freedom and justice were bad ideas? But yes, they were. Forget your democracies, they said. Look at them. They're weak, they're unstable, they're inefficient, they're sliding down slippery slopes of moral decline. Look at your partisan gridlock, look at your bickering politicians. Instead of greatness, you get watered down compromise, if you get anything at all. If you want something to get done, you can't do it by committee, you need someone strong, someone who can take control. As cynical and manipulative as that argument might be, they are actually trying to get the world to believe that democracy is corrupt and that it is a failed experiment. And to my utter bafflement, I have watched people actually buy it. Even here in America, it leaves me speechless, incredulous, because democracy is not a failed experiment. Democracy is fucking awesome. Putin and Xi Jinping are wrong. Exchanging liberty and justice for security or purity or to save your country is a fool's bargain. How is it that this case even needs to be made? Freedom is like sunsets and a loving family and indoor plumbing. It's something that never gets old. It's something that everyone could agree is wonderful and sacred. I thought we held these truths to be self-evident. But maybe that is actually the problem. For me, growing up in a democracy was like living with a mouthful of non-toothaches. You know a non-toothache? It's when your mouth is so free of pain that you don't notice your teeth. The freedoms that I had were that way. I didn't even really know they existed because I'd never felt the pain of not having them. But as I learned about the world, I began to understand just how full it was of people who didn't get democracy for free. 15-year-old girls shot in the face for claiming their right to go to school. Political prisoners beaten to death only to have their official cause of death listed as fell in the shower. Journalists murdered and dismembered in their own embassy because they told stories that a ruler found embarrassing. Innocent men murdered for the color of their skin by mobs who then posed next to the hanging corpse for a picture postcard. Do you know how the Arab Spring started? Do you remember? Mohamed Bouazizi grew up and worked most of his young life on his uncle's farm. A farm that was repossessed by the bank when it became insolvent. And so with no other livelihood, Mohamed moved to the city where in an attempt to support his family, he would buy food on credit to resell on the street. Such a life would be hard enough. But Mohammed didn't just have to contend with creditors, he had to contend with the police. These police regularly shook down vendors for bribes, demanding to see vending licenses that no law required them to have. And if you didn't pay up, they took your wares. This is what happened to Mohammed. After borrowing about $200 to buy produce to sell at the market, the police came by to demand their cut. And when he refused, they toppled his cart, took his scales, and beat him. And then they left him there. What was he to do? He had nothing left. Nothing. $200 of debt and a hungry family. So he complained to the local officials. But they blew him off. Can you imagine the desperation he must have felt to walk out into traffic in front of the governor's office, douse himself in gasoline, and set himself ablaze with a match? That is what happens when police have power over people who do not in turn have power over the police. Right now, there are people all over the world who have to live in fear of their governments. People who have to watch what they say and who they say it to and where they say it. Until recently, I have lived my whole life without that worry. But that could have been me. It could have been you. In the cosmic lottery of human souls, what were our chances of being born in Venezuela or in Afghanistan or in North Korea? But I wasn't. I walked out of my house today without being spied on. No militia checked my papers or evaluated whether my head was appropriately covered. I went to work at a job that I could quit whenever I wanted. But I won't, because it enables me to do work that I love. I went to a library where I could read any book I wanted. I listened to a news program that I trust, not censored by the government, but still held to high principles of journalism by its fact-checking competitors. And right now, on this podcast, I can tell you a story that is critical of very powerful people, and you can listen to it without it being intercepted by some government censor. And today, at least, I do so without fear that I will be imprisoned or assassinated or tortured. The only reason that I feel secure in these rights is that my ancestors, brave men and women of all colors and faiths, risked demanding them, risked wresting them from the hands of power over and over again. This is not a failed experiment. That is a smashing success. The autocrats may be right about how democracies are inefficient or prone to gridlock, but that is democracy's greatest wonder. We argue instead of going to arms. We debate instead of bombing each other's children. And freedom may be the greatest blessing of democracy, but it's not the only one. In democracies, famine is virtually unknown. It is in autocracies where people starve. In the mid-20th century, communist dictators decided, under the influence of Trofim-Lyshenko, that genetics and evolution smacked too much of bourgeois ideas about competition, and therefore were anti-communist. Scientists who wouldn't back Lyshenko's supposed Marxist science of vernalization, and there were thousands of them, were fired and outcast and imprisoned and tortured and murdered. And when this bogus theory was enforced on the collective farms of the Soviets and later in Mao's Great Leap Forward, tens of millions of people died. Tens of millions. Tens of millions more were stunted and scarred by starvation. More death and misery than all the nuclear and chemical weapons ever unleashed on the world. Shit like that doesn't happen in democracies. We throw those bastards out. People who live in democracies are less likely to starve and more likely to know peace and stability. They have more education. They have more opportunities to find fulfilling work. There is more innovation in their societies and in study after study after study. They are happier. Right now, if you're living in the United States, you might be thinking, Jesus, Ben, appreciation is not what we need right now. The goddamn house is on fire. This is an emergency. We have got to do something. And you're right. In the next few episodes, I'll talk about hope and help. I know this is an emergency. And it's okay to feel angry and afraid. Anger helps us face those who hurt us. And fear helps to keep us safe. But anger and fear are not enough. There is a difference between protecting something because you are afraid to lose it and protecting something because you love it. Giving thanks for democracy is not a substitute for action. It is a practical and strategic action on its own. It is strategic because fear is paralyzing and anger burns itself out. Anger and fear weren't enough to win women the right to vote or reintegrate schools or to bring down the Berlin Wall. Love of freedom and justice sustain action long after fear and anger have been reduced to despair. Think about it. What parent wouldn't go to the ends of the earth to free their children? And that is exactly what we're fighting for. Remembering the sweetness of our freedoms enlists and inspires us. Instead of making enemies, love builds coalitions. Loving our freedoms will give us wisdom and courage, and not just us. When other people hear us proclaim our love, it will give them strength and hope and the courage to take action, and it will remind them that they are not alone. So what are we waiting for? Let's get out there. Let's point out every non-toothache we can to everyone who will listen. Let's let every attack on our neighbors and on the balance of power remind us of how good those neighbors are and how wise those checks and balances. And let's feed each other's convictions and our courage with gratitude. Because there are millions of us. Now is the time to notice. Our democracies are one of the greatest things that humans have ever made, and they are worth believing in. If you are lucky enough to live in one, look around. Rejoice in your libraries and your schools and the juries of your peers. Rejoice in the diversity of faiths and colors and traditions. Anyone can help with this. It's not hard. Here's what you do. Think about the freedoms and the institutions that make you proud and happy, and then tell someone how wonderful they are. Tell a friend, write a letter to the editor, post it on your socials, write a song. Let's start a chorus of gratitude for freedom, a million voices strong. And let's keep singing it as we get down to business. I don't know if the moment ever comes whether I will have the courage to stand down the tanks. But if I do, it will be because I love my kids and I love my country. I just hope that if I ever get there, I won't have to do it alone. Please, sing with me. If you want to sing with me, here's one way to do it. Post your appreciations about democracy on the I Heart This podcast Facebook page or in the comments on the YouTube edition of this episode. Your words might be just the thing to inspire fellow listeners, or maybe you'll find just the thing to inspire you. Let's work together to put something out in the internet besides outrage and despair. I'd love to see you there. And if you know someone who might be buoyed up and inspired by this episode, consider sharing it. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. New episodes every Wednesday. Visit our archive at iheartthispodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook at iheartthispodcast for announcements of episode releases. And thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.